KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A judge said the deportation of a Venezuelan immigrant, quote, shocks the conscience because he had protection against deportation. She gave the government a deadline to bring him back. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. With a new administration in power, who feels more free to share their views? And who feels more silenced? I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm E. Martinez. All this week, we'll be discussing this fundamental right in our special series, The State of the First Amendment. Also, RFK Jr. says vaccines are the most effective way to stop measles, but also touts unproven treatments. And our new all-time hockey goal scorer unseats Wayne Gretzky at the top of the list. It's Monday, April 7th. Academy Award winner Russell Crowe has been the insider and gladiator today. Birthday boy, he's 61 years old. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Investors in the U.S. and around the world are registering their dismay over President Trump's trade war. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled about 900 points in early trading.
10% tariffs on nearly everything the U.S. imports took effect over the weekend. Unless something changes, even higher import taxes on goods from dozens of countries are set to kick in on Wednesday. That's sparking fears of higher prices and slower economic growth. On his way back to Washington from a golfing weekend in Florida last night, President Trump told reporters, quote, "Sometimes you have to take medicine to fix something." Investors around the world are finding the president's trade war a bitter pill. Asian markets dropped sharply overnight. Oil prices briefly dipped below $60 a barrel. But retail gasoline prices in the U.S. continue to climb. They're up about 9 cents a gallon in the last week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
One supporter of President Trump's tariffs is the president of the United Auto Workers. Sean Fain says while Wall Street is slumping, no one is looking out for working class Americans.
There's a bigger issue here. So when I hear all the crying about the stock market, this is just Wall Street. You know, there are people that are already rich. And at the end of the day, most working class people are trying to survive right now. And it's infuriating that our livelihoods have been stripped from us for decades and no one's cared.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. The powerful storms that have been pummeling much of central, midwestern, and southern states have pulled away, but dangerous flooding remains. Parts of a dozen states are under some kind of flood caution from Ohio to Texas. That's because the rain has swollen rivers and streams. Numerous rivers are in major flood stage. Areas at risk include Arkansas, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Israel's military says it targeted a man in Gaza who took part in attacking Israel. Gaza's health ministry says two people were killed and nine others wounded in the airstrike by Israel on a press tent occupied by Palestinian journalists. NPR's Aya Batrawi reports the attack did not kill the Israeli military's intended target.
The attack was filmed by other journalists, showing a makeshift tent on fire and a man slumped on a chair in flames. The Committee to Protect Journalists says 85 journalists were killed last year by Israel. The group says this is the highest number on record of journalists ever killed by a country in a year, and says several were targeted because of their work. Israel has acknowledged some of these attacks, alleging the journalists had ties with Hamas. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry says nearly 60 people were killed in the past 24 hours across the territory. One video circulating online and confirmed by the health ministry shows the lifeless body of a young child with his head severed from an airstrike Sunday in central Gaza, a city Israel says militants fired rockets from. Another airstrike also in central Gaza has trapped 15 people under the rubble. Aya Batrawi, NPR News, Dubai.
Wall Street continues to slump. The Dow is now down more than 1,000 points. You're listening to NPR. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to bring back a Maryland man deported to an El Salvador prison. U.S. District Judge Paula Zinis explains the U.S. actions are, quote, wholly lawless. She has ordered that the Maryland man be returned by the end of the day today. A U.S. immigration judge had previously forbade the U.S. from deporting him. The Justice Department is appealing the order. Colon cancer is a leading cause of cancer-related death worldwide. NPR's Maria Godoy reports new research finds regular exercise can help survivors live longer.
While colon cancer death rates overall have been falling, survivors still tend to have a shorter life expectancy than the general population. In a new study, researchers surveyed nearly 3,000 colon cancer patients about their exercise habits during and after treatment. Dr. Jeff Meyerhart of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute says for patients who were 3 years cancer-free, exercise made a big difference.
Those patients not only had a better overall survival if they were more physically active, they actually looked like they had a slightly better overall survival compared to the general population.
Even patients whose cancer recurred had improvements in survival if they were doing the equivalent of a brisk walk for about an hour a day on most days. The findings appear in the journal Cancer. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
In pro hockey, Washington Capitals star Alex Ovechkin broke the all-time NHL scoring record yesterday. He's now scored 895 times in his 20 seasons in the NHL. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin. We've been talking to Americans across the country who are worried. Worried they may be losing a fundamental right. So many are so nervous talking about it that our conversations would start like this. Would you be comfortable with us using your full name?
I'd rather not.
Can we just use my first initial? I'm definitely worried about getting reported.
Others backed out of interviews, afraid of retaliation. But then there are those who are louder and bolder in this moment.
President Trump has made a commitment to bring back freedom of speech in our country. And I think conservatives are just, in general, much more willing to speak their mind.
All this week, we are going to look at the state of free speech in the United States. Who feels more free to speak? Who feels silenced? And the way this First Amendment right seems to be shifting. For a Florida pastor who was spit on for a sermon he recently gave.
They just sort of shut down the conversation by saying, I'm putting you on a list. It's somewhat intimidating.
A sixth grade teacher forced to remove an everyone is welcome here sign.
I've lost quite a lot of sleep over this matter and have struggled with it deeply.
A conservative parental rights group called Moms for Liberty that the Southern Poverty Law Center deems extremist.
I think people in the administration really want to see changes that will open up the government more, and that's good for all Americans. I have a lot of hope.
And immigration attorneys representing student protesters in danger of deportation.
These are test cases. If the government can get away with doing this to these students, it can do it to everybody in this country. Your citizenship won't save you. Your views will be next.
Will your views be next? Is President Trump a protector of the First Amendment, or is he the biggest threat to it since the McCarthy era in the 1940s and 50s, when fear-mongering around Soviet and communist influence led to the political persecution of academics and leftists?
One communist on the faculty of one university is one communist too many.
We'll be exploring those questions in the sciences, education, the media, and beyond in this morning edition series the state of the First Amendment, the right from which all other rights flow. Hours after he was sworn in, President Trump brandished a Sharpie at the Capital One Arena in Washington, D.C. and signed a flurry of executive orders. Among them was a directive to the federal government.
Ordering the restoration of freedom of speech and preventing government censorship of free speech going forward.
Weeks later, in an address to Congress, Trump touted it as a return to freedom.
I've stopped all government censorship and brought back free speech in America. It's back.
In anticipation of this moment, social media companies were already backing away from fact-checking. And as Trump celebrated, certain voices re-entered the mainstream. And a warning, what you're about to hear is hate speech.
Around blacks, never relax.
Yet the invasion continues. Our country has been sold out to foreigners of the lowest form.
Let's make sure to honor all of our transgender mass shooters as the International Transgender Day of Visibility is upon us.
Trump's promises to end federal censorship come hand in hand with attacks on the press.
And I believe that CNN and MSDNC, who literally write 97.6% bad about me, are political arms of the Democrat Party. And in my opinion, they're really corrupt and they're illegal. What they do is illegal.
He's barred the AP from the Oval Office for their refusal to call the Gulf of Mexico only the Gulf of America. NPR, The New York Times, Politico, and NBC were kicked out of their Pentagon offices, and others were asked to give up their offices later. And for the first time, the president, rather than the press, is handpicking the pool of reporters that cover his activities. He's broken other norms as well, often in legally questionable ways.
Universities face uncertain futures as they become targets of the Trump administration.
This week, they arrested yet another student.
Trump retaliating against law firms that have worked on cases against him.
In order to understand whether this moment in U.S. history is unprecedented, we turn to two free speech legal scholars. The first, Lee Bollinger. He's the former president of Columbia University and one of the foremost voices on the First Amendment.
The Supreme Court has held really definitively and in many cases that in public debate, public discussion of public issues, we will have wide open, robust free speech that will include very offensive and even very, very deeply dangerous speech. Speech that would advocate hate or advocacy of overthrow of the government, violence, all of that is protected until just at the moment where it's about to occur.
And Jonathan Turley, also a known legal scholar on the First Amendment, frequent commentator on Fox News, and the author of The Indispensable Right, Free Speech in the Age of Rage.
The framers wanted to create a protection around what they saw as a natural right, a right that pre-existed government, a right that makes people fully human.
A right to assemble, a right to practice any religion or no religion, a right to a free press and to freely criticize the government. Now, Turley and Bollinger have both spent their lives advocating and trying to protect this basic right, but they see the threats to it in this moment differently. Bollinger sees danger under Trump.
When the government, the White House, excludes reporters or a media outlet like AP, that to me is an act of threat because you're doing it because of the content, because they're not towing the line to the government position. And when you say we're not going to give contracts to any corporation that promotes DEI, you're really using the enormous power of the federal government to force people not to talk in certain ways and to think in certain ways. When you go after universities and say that you can no longer do this, have this kind of academic decision making, and if you do, we're going to cut off enormous amounts of traditional funding for research, all of that has a chilling effect, it's called, on speech and on independent institutions in the society.
Do you think it's possible to lose, like in this moment, that it could be lost?
So it's always possible. When I look back over, let's say, the last century, there have been every, 20, 30 years, periods where there was a real, real retreat from the commitment to free speech. I think we are heading in that direction.
Now, Turley says he thinks this president could be an unexpected advocate.
Ironically, our greatest allies tend to be people who were subject to censorship. Trump is an example of that. I mean, he was banned from social media. Even though I disagreed with some of his statements, I more strongly disagreed with his being banned from being able to express them on social media.
His alarm actually grew under President Biden over what he says was collusion between the government, social media companies, and academia to shut down conservative speech around polarizing issues like elections, public health, and beyond.
You had a level of cooperation, coordination between the government and these other entities that the effect was that thousands were censored.
It's a charge often made by Republicans and Trump allies. Last year, the Supreme Court rejected the claim that social media companies were pressured to take down posts about COVID-19 and the 2020 election.
The familiar pattern is that people always start with a relatively small subset of views that are considered too dangerous to allow, and then it tends to metastasize.
He says this quest against mis and disinformation got out of hand and ended up silencing people. In your view, is there any place where there does need to be limitations?
I admit that, and perhaps I'm a bit of a dinosaur in the sense, I believe that the solution of bad speech is good speech. In history, you can't point to a single censorship system that has ever succeeded, that has ever stopped one idea or one movement. It has a 100% failure rate, and yet we continue to try to replicate it. The thing that actually stops disinformation is information. It is people being able to call out others for false statements.
But I also want to talk about what's happening now. There have been many actions by this administration that seem to be chilling speech. College professors warning students not to discuss or post opinions about Israel's war in Gaza or Russia's war in Ukraine for fear of deportation or arrest. Government websites have taken down thousands of pages featuring information on vaccines, hate crimes, diversity. Are free speech protections broadening right now under President Trump, or is censorship shifting?
Well, it's too early to tell whether the Trump administration will make free speech truly part of its legacy in the second term. As someone in the free speech community, we make no assumptions as to our allies in any of these fights. We've had our hearts broken too many times.
Where Bollinger and Turley do agree is the case of Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia student protester and green card holder facing deportation, if he and other students are being removed for their choice to protest.
These students, and including permanent residents, are allowed to protest in favor of Palestine, to criticize Israel. That's part of the core protections that define us as a people.
If you look back over the history of the First Amendment, a number of the major cases involved efforts to go after immigrants, a very vulnerable population, easy to scapegoat.
Tomorrow, a look at the immigration crackdown across university campuses.
Americans should be horrified by what's happening right now. People are being grabbed out of their homes. They're being taken off the sidewalk by gangs of federal agents.
Is the administration wielding immigration as a tool for censorship? This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, Scottish actor David Tennant. Perhaps best known for his role as the Doctor on Doctor Who, Tennant also is considered an excellent Shakespearean actor. His comedy show, staged with Michael Sheen, was one of the few funny things to come out of the COVID pandemic. The third season of his podcast is out now. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice. At ajws.org. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez. A second child in Texas has died of measles, according to state health officials.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. attended the child's funeral on Sunday and identified the child as 8-year-old Daisy Hildebrand. Until this year, the United States had not reported a measles death for nearly a decade. Now an outbreak centered in Texas has 481 confirmed cases.
NPR's Maria Godoy has been following all this for us. So Maria, the second child to die of measles this year. We've learned that she died on Thursday. What else do we know about her?
Well, Texas health officials say the girl was not vaccinated and had no reported underlying health conditions. She was hospitalized after getting sick with measles, and she died from what doctors described as measles pulmonary failure, which basically means the lungs can't really provide enough oxygen anymore.
And is this a common complication from the measles?
You know, measles is a respiratory illness, and it can often lead to serious lung complications, including pneumonia, superinfections of the lung, as well as other complications like brain swelling. Vaccines work so well that many of us have forgotten just how devastating measles can be. This latest death serves as a terrible reminder.
So how worried should people be for the possibility of more deaths?
Well, before the first measles vaccines were developed in the early 1960s, measles used to kill 400 to 500 people in this country every year. Even now, about 1 or 2 out of every 1,000 measles cases are fatal. I spoke with Dr. Adam Ratner. He's a pediatric infectious disease specialist in New York, and he is unfortunately not surprised by these fatalities.
Every time a child gets the measles, you roll the dice and you have a 1 in 1,000 or a 2 in 1,000 chance of that child dying. So it's not surprising that in an outbreak of this size that we are starting to see deaths.
Ratner says these are deaths that vaccines could prevent, and vaccination rates have been trending downwards nationwide for several years. He says especially in areas like Gaines County, Texas, where the outbreak is centered and where vaccination rates are just above 80%, that just sets the stage for outbreaks because measles is extraordinarily contagious.
Yeah. How has the Trump administration responded to all this?
Well, Secretary Kennedy traveled to Texas on Sunday. He said the CDC is deploying teams to Texas to help with the outbreak. And he called the measles vaccine, quote, the most effective way to prevent the spread of measles. And that is notable because in prior statements, he's called vaccines a personal choice. But in another post Sunday, Kennedy praised doctors' use of treatments that have no evidence to support them when it comes to measles. And, you know, meanwhile, President Trump was asked about the outbreak on Sunday night. He downplayed the size, but he said if it progresses, the U.S. will have to take what he called very strong action. And I should note that we are seeing these outbreaks at a time when the administration has moved to cut more than $11 billion in public health funding to states.
So, Maria, I mean, what now with measles in the U.S.?
Well, so measles was declared eliminated in this country in 2000, but this year we have 5 states where measles is currently spreading. In fact, the U.S. has already seen more than 600 measles cases this year. That's more than double the number of cases it reported in all of last year, and it's only April.
That's NPR's Maria Godoy. Thank you very much, Maria.
My pleasure.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Some other news now. Hockey has a new scoring king. Alex Ovechkin became the NHL's all-time goal scorer yesterday with the 895th goal of his career. Here's NPR's Becky Sullivan.
It's been more than three decades since hockey's all-time goals record last changed hands. That was in 1994 when Wayne Gretzky, the great one, broke Gordie Howe's old record as he rewrote all of hockey's history books. Gretzky can still recall the night.
When I broke Gordie's record, my dad told me that same night, you'd be as proud of the guy that breaks your record.
By the time he retired, Gretzky had scored 894 goals in his regular season career. And there was a time, a really long time, when people thought that record might never be broken. Then along came Alex Ovechkin. The Washington Capitals drafted the Moscow native in 2004, and he's scored goals by the bucketful ever since, including 42 this season, the third most in the NHL, even though he's a decade older than the league's other top scorers. This winter and spring, as he inched closer and closer to Gretzky's record, with every Capitals game, everybody would lean in every time number 8 touched the puck. History finally arrived Sunday, in the second period of a game against the New York Islanders. The Capitals were on a power play. Across the ice came a pass from a teammate. Ovechkin reached back with his stick to control the puck, then flung it toward the net for the 895th goal of his legendary career. It's heard here on the Monumental Sports Network.
Ovechkin fires! Score! The chasing days are done! Alex Ovechkin is the greatest goal scorer in the history of the NHL.
The 39-year-old dove to the ice belly first as his teammates poured off the bench in a happy mob. The crowd went wild. Even the Islanders squad lined up to each shake Ovi's hand. The game was put on pause as Ovechkin's family, the NHL commissioner, and of course, Wayne Gretzky came down to the ice for a ceremony.
They say records are made to be broken, but I'm not sure who's going to get more goals than that.
Afterward, at a press conference, Ovechkin said he was still taking it all in.
I'm probably going to need a couple more days or maybe a couple weeks to realize what does it mean to be number one. But all I can say, I'm very proud.
The Capitals are one of the best teams in hockey this season, playoff bound with a real shot at a second franchise Stanley Cup. But for weeks, Ovechkin's chase had loomed larger than all of that.
I mean, there's really no words to describe it.
The Capitals' Tom Wilson has been Ovechkin's teammate for 12 seasons.
What Wayne and O have done for the game of hockey can never be replicated. It's been an honor of my career to just have a front row seat and watch him.
One day it'll be Ovechkin's turn to shake the next guy's hand. But it took 31 years for him to break Gretzky's record. So don't expect that day to come anytime soon. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
In Brazil, a Chinese electric car company is moving into an old Ford manufacturing plant.
It's a message of we're the future and Ford was the past, that China is a stable and reliable trade partner, and the Americans are sometimes not.
I'm Ari Shapiro. As new tariffs close off U.S. markets, the world's largest electric car maker is turning to Latin America. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Investors on Wall Street continue selling amid rattled nerves over President Trump's sweeping tariffs and what they might mean for the U.S. economy. NPR's John Ruwich in Beijing says stocks in Asia tumbled today.
In Asia, it was a bloodbath, with equity markets from Australia to Vietnam plunging. Some clocked record drops. Hong Kong's benchmark Hang Seng Index fell more than 13%, its biggest one-day drop since 1997, the year Britain handed the territory back to China.
Right now, the Dow is down 728 points. Tariffs are among the issues President Trump is expected to discuss with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today at the White House. Here's NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi.
This is Netanyahu's second visit to the U.S. since President Trump took office. The last one was in January. Netanyahu's office has said he expects to talk with Trump about the 17% tariffs the U.S. imposed on Israel. Now, Netanyahu tried to avoid getting those slapped on Israel the night before they were announced by voiding Israeli custom duties on American products, which, you know, obviously didn't work.
Speaking to reporters yesterday aboard Air Force One, Trump said lots of countries are now seeking to negotiate with the U.S. over tariffs. He's urging Americans to be patient. This is NPR News from Washington. Flood warnings are in effect this morning from areas of Ohio and West Virginia to Texas. At least 18 deaths are reported from recent days of stormy weather, including tornadoes and flash flooding. Most of the fatalities occurred in Tennessee. Houston and Florida will be squaring off tonight in San Antonio in the NCAA Men's Division I College Basketball Championship. As Dan Katz with Texas Public Radio reports, Houston advanced to the title game by rallying to beat Duke in one tournament semifinal, while Florida knocked off Auburn in the other.
Houston was down 14 to Duke with 8 minutes to go when they went on a furious run with several defensive stands and clutch shots, pulling off a 70-67 upset. Earlier in the night, Florida mounted a run of its own against Auburn after being down 8 at halftime, winning 79-73. Houston is playing for its first ever title, and Florida is back in the title game for the first time since it won back-to-back championships in 2006 and 2007. I'm Dan Katz in San Antonio.
In the women's bracket, UConn is celebrating its record 12th national championship. The Huskies rolled over defending national champion South Carolina yesterday, 82-59. It was UConn's first championship in 9 years. Stocks remain lower on Wall Street at the moment. The Dow is down 686 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Trump administration has until midnight to return a man who was deported to a mega prison in El Salvador by mistake.
A federal judge ordered the administration to bring back Kiomar Armando Abrego Garcia, who was arrested and deported last month in what the judge described as an illegal act. The Justice Department is appealing that order, and it placed the attorney who argued its case on administrative leave.
NPR correspondent Joel Rose joins us now with more. So, Joel, let's start with the judge's order. Why did she direct the Trump administration to bring him back?
Yeah, the Trump administration has admitted that he was deported by mistake because of what they describe as an administrative error. Abrego Garcia had been living in Maryland for over a decade. He has a form of legal protection known as withholding of removal. In spite of that, ICE officers arrested Abrego Garcia last month, and a few days later, he was deported to El Salvador along with hundreds of other men accused of being gang members. But the Justice Department argues there is nothing they can do now because Abrego Garcia is already out of the U.S. Federal District Judge Paula Zinnes rejected that argument. She found that his arrest was, quote, wholly lawless. His ongoing detention in a Salvadoran prison, quote, shocks the conscience. She noted that the U.S. is paying El Salvador to hold these prisoners, and she ordered the Trump administration to bring him back to Maryland by midnight tonight.
All right. What has the Trump administration said?
They are not backing down. The White House insists that Abrego Garcia is a member of the Salvadoran gang called MS-13, though his lawyers deny that. They say that allegation dates back to the time he was arrested in 2019 in the parking lot of a Home Depot. His lawyers say the gang allegation is based largely on a confidential informant who accused Abrego Garcia of being a member of the gang in New York, which is a state where he has never lived. Abrego Garcia's lawyers say he has no criminal record in any country. Nevertheless, the White House has doubled down, calling Abrego Garcia a leader in MS-13 and a convicted gang member. But if the Trump administration has evidence to support that, they have not put it on the record in this case. Judge Zinnes said during the hearing that without any evidence, like a criminal indictment or complaint, these gang allegations are just quote-unquote chatter.
Joel, I saw over the weekend the Justice Department put the attorney who argued the case on Friday on administrative leave. Why did that happen?
This is remarkable. The Justice Department lawyer, Erez Ruveni, argued the case on Friday. Ruveni has argued many cases on immigration for administrations of both parties, and he had some very candid answers for Judge Zinnes. The judge asked him why the administration did not try to return Abrego Garcia to the U.S. when they first learned about this mistake. Ruveni said he had asked his clients inside the Trump administration the very same thing and that, quote, I have not received to date an answer that I find satisfactory. The next day, he was put on leave, administrative leave, by the Justice Department. Here is Attorney General Pam Bondi explaining why yesterday on Fox News Sunday.
I firmly said on day one, I issued a memo that you are to vigorously advocate on behalf of the United States. He shouldn't have taken the case. He shouldn't have argued it if that's what he was going to do.
So, Joel, what's happened now?
The Justice Department is appealing. They argue that courts do not have jurisdiction over this case because Abrego Garcia is in the custody of El Salvador, and essentially there is nothing that Judge Zinnes can do. The Justice Department is asking the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals for an emergency stay, but if they do not get one, that midnight deadline will still be in place. And then the big question is whether they will comply with it.
All right, that's NPR's Joel Rose. Joel, thank you.
You're welcome.
Many Wall Street figures and billionaires supported President Trump's election, and some seem unpersuaded by the president imposing tariffs on the world. Billionaire Bill Ackman is urging the president he supported to call a truce and avoid economic nuclear war. Elon Musk, this morning, posted a free trade tutorial by the economist Milton Friedman. One reason economists have raised their risk of recession is because tariffs are taxes that tend to raise prices. So what can the rest of us do about that? Michelle Singletary is a personal finance columnist at the Washington Post and also writes the biweekly column, The Color of Money. Michelle, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay, first question. If people are anticipating higher prices, should they be rushing out to stock up on food or toothpaste or whatever?
I don't think so. You don't want to tie that money up. You might actually need that money instead of for toothpaste for more food on the table. If you were in the market for a car, you were already shopping, you have the funds for it, I would say definitely pull that trigger right now. There's some automakers that are giving incentives for people. So go ahead and make that purchase before that price actually spikes up.
Oh, that's interesting. And I suppose that would be true of a lot of consumer purchases, right? Like if you're thinking about buying a new phone, for example, phone prices may go up.
That's exactly right. But if you were only in the market, you're like, oh, I kind of want a better camera, but you don't really need it, I would not do that. Because if you lose your job, that $1,000 could go towards your rent.
And now that's an interesting point. Should people be thinking about losing their jobs? The employment market still seems strong, according to the latest figures.
It is still strong, but you know, if there is a recession, and this could happen fairly quickly in terms of the downturn, you want to preserve as much cash as possible. So if you are in a good position, you've got money coming in and some sort of fixed income, and you've got a good savings, and you were going to buy something that you had already planned for, I would do that. But if you are already living paycheck to paycheck, your emergency fund is really low or non-existent, please cut back now. Don't wait for to see the prices spike. Put that money away just in case you get hit by these tariffs.
Okay, so I'm thinking through your advice. Don't panic. Don't rush out and buy stuff. If you were already going to buy something, get it done. Save some money. Let's talk about something else here. People have retirement accounts. A lot of those accounts are invested in the stock market. They've been watching those numbers going down. What would you say for people to do there?
Stop watching the numbers. Don't look at your portfolio. I haven't looked at my retirement portfolio since Trump announced that he was going to do these tariffs and the market started to slide. I can't stomach looking at the actual numbers. I know that it's down, but I don't want to see the exact numbers because I'm not going to be touching that money for quite some time. And that's my advice for people. Just don't look. If you are in retirement, it's hard not to look if you're pulling it out, but don't. I'm not going to say don't panic because this is your money. You've worked hard for it and you need to feel what you need to feel. But please don't act on those fears because even in retirement, you could have another 20 or 30 years before you need to touch all of that money. So pull out just what you need and let the rest sit.
I just want to remember the stock market crashed around the year 2000, came back. The stock market crashed in 2008, came back after a few years. So it does come back. But do you worry that something fundamental has changed in the world trading system here?
Yes, I do and don't. The basic economy for the U.S. is sound. It is the policies that are tipping us into this direction. And those policies could change on a dime, which they have. And so if there is some resolution to it, then the markets will bounce back. But until it does, I understand that is a very, very scary ride.
Washington Post personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary, thanks for the insights.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Law firms threatened with executive orders are bowing to President Trump's demands that they commit millions to right-wing causes. We'll hear from one firm that's fighting back. Next time on Here and Now.
Staying informed is more vital than ever. With NPR by your side, it is easy to keep up with the latest news. We're at your fingertips on your phone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. San Francisco's closing part of an oceanside highway to turn it into a park, and there's a meeting this week to decide on a name. An online survey was done, and here are some suggestions. Playland Park by the Beach or People's Park, but opponents of the park got in on the naming action too. Worst park ever. This is stupid. Let's not do it. If I got to choose, I would go with roughly what 100 people sent in. Parky McParkface. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez. University of Connecticut is back on top of women's college basketball after a dominating 23-point win over defending champ South Carolina. It's the first championship win for the UConn women since 2016 and a record 12th title overall. It also gives UConn star and senior Paige Beckers the last thing missing from her impressive collegiate resume. After the game, she spoke about what it meant.
So many emotions. Gratitude was the main one of the journey, of the ups and downs, of everything that it took to get to that point, and just overwhelming joy, and just so happy for every single person who was a part of this journey.
Tonight, it's the men's championship, University of Florida versus the University of Houston, and they face off in San Antonio. That's where reporter Greg Eklund is there to give us a preview. So, Greg, all the Final Four teams' number one seeds, the two playing in the championship game tonight are very different. In what way?
Well, it starts with the coaches leading the teams. Kelvin Sampson, the head coach of the Houston Cougars, will turn 70 later this year. He became a college head coach in the 1980s and has taken two different schools to the Final Four, Oklahoma in 2002 and Houston in 2022, but has never made it to the title game. If the Cougars win, Sampson would become the oldest Division I head coach to capture a championship. Florida's coach, Todd Golden, will turn 40 in July and is in his third year as the Gators head coach after previously being at the University of San Francisco.
And two of the other big differences, too, is that Florida is the third highest scoring team in the country. Houston has the best defense in the country. So two forces going up against each other. I can't wait to see it. And the basketball history, too, Greg, at each school is pretty different.
Oh, yes. Most people probably think of Florida as a football school, but it's no stranger to basketball success either. The Gators repeated as NCAA champions in 2006 and 2007. When the Gators played in the Saturday night semifinal, former Gators coach Billy Donovan was there because he was named earlier in the day as part of this year's Basketball Hall of Fame class. He coached the Gators in 06 and 07. That moment was not lost on Golden.
I would say it was really neat, you know, to be able to do it with him in the building, with him being honored, you know, and for all of our fans and supporters that were here, just an incredible full circle moment.
Houston has been to the Final Four seven times, but hasn't won a championship. That's the most Final Four appearances for Division I school without a title.
Which is shocking, Greg, because they have had some incredible ball players.
Yes, they have. The Cougars are making the school's first title game appearance since 1984 when Hakeem Olajuwon was the starting center. Olajuwon attended the semifinal game, and Clyde Drexler, another starter on that team, expected to be in attendance tonight. They were regulars in the NBA. Cougars forward Juwan Roberts says he knows a national championship is not only important to this team, but a tribute to everyone who's played at Houston.
You can see, you know, on their face that they're especially happy knowing that they went to University of Houston, and for us to be, you know, back at the top from where they was at.
This game should be a treat. The Houston Cougars rely on their defense, limiting opponents to only 59 points a game, and Florida likes to score, averaging 85 points a game. So something has to give.
Yeah, something has to give. I know Florida is favored by 1.5 points. You don't can't score a half point, but that means it's going to be a pretty close game. That's sports reporter Greg Eklund in San Antonio, the site of tonight's men's championship title game. Greg, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Stephen Skeep.
wildly swinging stock market in the last hour amid confusion about pausing tariffs or not.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, with a reminder that spring cleaning isn't just for closets. Bitwarden is designed to help clean up weak or reused passwords and secure sensitive information across all logins and devices. Bitwarden.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Stock market indicators started way down today, but then shot into positive territory for a brief moment. And as we speak, are back deeply into negative territory, at least for the Dow and the S&P. Hard to believe that about a half hour ago, the Dow had been up 3.5% for a brief second. Marketplace's Nova Safo is here with more.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of confusing messages from the White House. White House National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett told CNBC this morning that a 90-day tariff pause for all countries except China was under consideration. But then CNBC reported that other White House advisors were unaware of any such pause. The back and forth highlighted the confusing set of messages coming from the White House and the uncertainty that's created. Over the weekend, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said some 50 countries have reached out to negotiate, raising the possibility that deals could be cut soon to lower the tariffs announced last week. But the president, speaking to reporters on Air Force One, David, on Sunday, appeared in no hurry to strike deals, saying he's aiming for zero deficits with other nations. The president also seemed unfazed by the global market reaction so far. And David, this morning he said he called on the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates.
All right, Nova, thank you. Okay, so here are the indicators at the moment. The Dow is now down 428 points, 1.1%. The S&P is down not so much, 0.4%, but the NASDAQ index just turned ever so slightly positive, up 8 points. Overnight, the Hang Seng Index in Hong Kong fell 13%, the biggest drop since the 1997 Asian financial crisis. But that drop is partly due to the fact that the market was closed Friday for a holiday. Here, the so-called stock market fear gauge, the VIX index of volatility, is up again today, the highest since the 2020 COVID lockdown and the 2008 financial crisis. Meanwhile, the EU's trade commissioner said just now that Europe has made a counteroffer to the White House, zero European import taxes on U.S. cars and other manufactured goods in return for zero U.S. import taxes on similar European Union exports. The EU says it remains open to talks, but, quote, we will not wait endlessly.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
A check it now on consumers and credit.
Here's the glass half-empty scenario brought to you by Ted Rossman at bankrate.com.
Credit card balances are at record highs, up more than 50% from 2021.
Delinquency rates have been rising since 2022, and more than 10% of credit card bills are more than 90 days late.
We're seeing more people using cards just to get by for groceries and gas.
Okay, now for the glass slightly more full.
Overall levels of debt to income, it looks pretty good.
Kurt Long at America's Credit Unions says most consumers can still afford to keep up, even with interest rates topping 20%. But he says that could change
if the labor market really starts to deteriorate.
Delinquencies tend to rise in lockstep with unemployment. And Ted Rossman's biggest worry?
Auto loans. Delinquencies there are worse than they were during the financial crisis.
People really try to pay that bill first, because if you don't, they repossess. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We are launching a new series today, Buy Now, Pay Later, it's called, focuses on retirees who still hold debt. Here's Marketplace's senior economics contributor, Chris Farrell.
Older Americans are increasingly carrying debt into retirement, and the amount of debt is also on the rise. Minling Zong is a senior research associate at the Urban Institute.
In 1989, about 58% of older adults over the age of 50 carry debt in retirement. And in 2020, that percentage has jumped to 78%.
Owing money isn't necessarily bad. Even upper-income households, say, earning $260,000 or more, take out loans to buy homes, cars, and appliances. Young adults borrow to pay for their education and to start a family. That said, the standard personal finance recommendation is to eliminate debt around retirement. Everyday life at older ages is financially riskier with debt, especially for people of modest means. Yet fewer near retirees and retirees are debt-free. Odette Williamson is senior attorney with the National Consumer Law Center.
It has to do with cutback in some safety net provisions. It has to do with increase in expenses, most recently due to inflation. And it has to do with the fact that older adults are aging with just fewer resources.
The combination of debt and low savings among older adults is pushing more households into the ranks of the financially precarious. Three major factors are driving the trend.
We found that the debt-creating institutions overwhelmed our wealth-creating institutions.
Teresa Ghilarducci is a professor of economics at the New School of Social Research. Ghilarducci says the value of home equity for the bottom 90%, measured by wealth, has barely increased over the past 40 years. Lenders made it easier to borrow from home equity, lower down payment requirements, and similar innovations. People also borrow to pay for the basics of modern life.
People were able to also get car loans and other kinds of durable consumer purchases on loans rather than cash.
Debt is also the other side of the lack of retirement savings coin. Nearly half of private sector workers and some two-thirds of lower wage workers don't have access to a retirement savings plan at work. Finally, wages rose slowly for most workers in recent decades, especially for Black, Latino, and women. Yet the costs of everyday living went up. Odette Williamson.
I'm seeing the debt increase for everyone, but it's a matter of whether you have the resources to deal with the debt.
Nearly half of older adults surveyed by AARP who are carrying a balance use credit cards to cover basic living expenses. Toss in home equity loans, medical debts, student loans, auto loans, and mortgages, and the accumulation of debt signals that too many older adults are living on a financial precipice. I'm Chris Farrell for Marketplace.
Our Buy Now, Pay Later coverage is a partnership with Next Avenue, a nonprofit news platform for older adults produced by Twin Cities PBS. The S&P 500 is up ever so slightly now. The Dow is still down. It's Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.